ID, the future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Recently, Daniel Reeves, Director of Education and Outreach with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, hosted an interactive online Q&A session with Stephen C. Meyer. It was focused mostly on Meyer's new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. And today, on ID the Future, we present excerpts from the first part of that session, including some surprising information about Meyer's past that many of his readers would never have guessed.
Good morning to everyone that's already on here. I'm sure we'll have others jumping in here in the next few minutes. But it's great to see that we have so many already ready to go. We actually have over 400 registrants today, so that's a great crowd, I think. So let me just go ahead and offer a quick introduction, if I may, and then I'll hand the mic over to Steve. So I know many of you know Steve already, so I won't go into too much introduction here. But for those of you who don't know, Steve studied at the University of Cambridge for his PhD in the philosophy of science. And he has served as a geophysicist, he served as a college professor at various times, and he's now directing our Center for Science and Culture here at Discovery Institute. And it's a privilege to work with you, Steve, by the way.
Well, likewise, Daniel, thank you.
Now, something you guys may not know about Steve that I thought I might share is, and this is something I always get a kick out of, is the fact that Steve is also a boxer, that he was asked to box for the University of Cambridge when he moved there to England. And in a recent conversation with his wife, Elaine, it just kind of struck me how that was so fitting that in both his academic career and also his athletic pursuits, that he's always kind of been a fighter, always willing to stand up to the bullies in the room, always willing to, you know, not willing to be shouted down by others. So I always thought that was kind of fitting. Now, just to be clear, Steve, did you actually accept that offer to box for Cambridge?
Well, I know you had this conversation with Elaine. She didn't tell me everything. That you were looking for some funny stories besides the academic biography.
That's right.
To introduce me. But no, it's one of the kind of really important conversations that we relay to our kids about, because I met this guy who was the captain of the boxing club in a course on the philosophy of mind. And he was sitting across the aisle from me. He had this bag of boxing gear. And I had a Russian coach when I first got out of college, when I was living in Dallas. So I asked him about it. And the next thing I knew, I was, you know, in the gym. I started training with them. They offered me the position for the middleweight on the Cambridge team. And Elaine thought I was just kind of, you know, working out a little bit. And I came home and I told her what had happened. I was all excited. And she, in this great moment of wisdom, said, "I thought we came here to develop the brain cells, not to ... And so as we got to
That's
thinking
killer,
about this,
yeah,
I mean, I was 30 already at the time, and it didn't maybe seem like the smartest thing to pursue. So I continued to train with the team the rest of the year and actually helped one of the guys who was on the junior varsity get ready for his match. But I decided to stick to the philosophy of science and not put at risk with the equipment I needed to accomplish that mission. So
right,
awesome. A very wise, wifely question.
Well, then I guess we can thank Elaine for the fact that we have this book that we're talking about today, because it might not exist otherwise.
Probably. Who knows what buzzsaw I might have run into if I'd gone forward. So.
Oh, that's so funny. All right. Well, as most of you know, the book that we're talking about today is actually the third of sort of a trilogy unofficially. So the first one was The Signature in the Cell, which many of you have read already. And as you know, it was named a Times Literary Supplement Book of the Year, which is quite the accomplishment. And then the second book was Darwin's Doubt. And so Darwin's Doubt also, even more impressively, was named a New York Times bestseller book. And that brings us to today's third and very highly anticipated book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. And there have been already in the first less than a month of it being released, been a number of accolades for this book. If you all haven't seen already, the book has already been named in just 3 or 4 weeks now a bestseller from both USA Today and Publishers Weekly. So that's no small accomplishment there. And Steve was also telling me that in the first couple of weeks, more copies were sold than many of the other books on the New York Times bestseller list. And so that says something as well. If you've seen on the book's website, it's been endorsed now by, I think, over 40 different scientists and scholars. You can read all those endorsements on the website. One that definitely stands out is from Brian Josephson, who is a emeritus professor of physics at the University of Cambridge. He's a fellow of the Royal Society and even a Nobel laureate in physics. And this is what he said about the book. He said, "This book makes it clear that far from being an unscientific claim, intelligent design is valid science." So that pretty much kind of sums up the argument there. And if you're interested, like I said, you can read through all sorts of other accolades and endorsements on the website, returnofthegodhypothesis.com. And this enormous success that we've seen for the book so far, just in about 4 weeks, is really a testament to the dedication of a whole team of folks working with Steve here at the Center for Science and Culture. So we've got Rob Crowther and David Klinghoffer and Brian Miller and Catherine West and several others who have been really pivotal in the production of the book, the review of the book, the marketing of the book, and together with our reps over at Harper One, of course. So a huge thanks to all of them. I don't want to waste any more time. I'm going to hand things over to Steve and feel free to share a little bit about kind of why you wrote the book, and then we'll jump into questions.
Yeah, absolutely, Daniel. One other person that definitely deserves mention and huge thanks is my assistant, Andrew McDermott, who also handles and coordinates a lot of our social media. He and Rob and David Klinghoffer have been at the point on our own internal promotion efforts around this, but Andrew was also deeply involved in helping me put the book together and gathering the footnotes and coordinating the internal editing process. And I know both Brian and Casey are on the call today too, and they were both crucial research assistants for me and discussion partners. They're much more than just research assistants because they're scientists in their own right. And Casey was hugely helpful in putting together Darwin's Doubt, and Ryan in this second book with all the physics and cosmology that's in it. So, let me just give a quick overview, because the title of the book obviously invites a story. And the story is this, that the God hypothesis has returned. That also says that at some point in the past, we lost it, which means that prior to that, it was present. And so, first of all, what do we mean by the God hypothesis? Well, two things. One, that the idea that God is a reality behind nature provides an explanatory framework for understanding some of the key developments in science. And that certainly was part of what's called the scientific revolution that took place between roughly 1500 and 1750. But during that period of time, the idea of God, but also specific ideas that came out of the Judeo-Christian context, the late Catholic medieval theology, the period of the Reformation, and the Christian thinkers who were drawing on concepts rediscovered from the Hebrew Bible, played a huge role in the rise of modern science. Concepts like the intelligibility of nature, the order of nature, and the idea that the order of nature was contingent on the will of the creator. So we had to go and look to see what kind of order was actually built into nature, that we couldn't just do a lot of armchair philosophizing like the Greeks had done. So historians of science see that what we call modern science arose in a decidedly Judeo-Christian milieu or context, and it did so for specifically Judeo-Christian reasons. There were worldview assumptions that made science possible that came out of that theistic and indeed even biblical framework. So the book starts by telling the story of that, but then it tells the story of how much of that framework was lost and replaced by the end of the 19th century with a much more materialistic or naturalistic worldview framework. And I emphasize the role of figures like Darwin, who had an origins theory, Freud, who had a theory of what was the future of mankind, a utopian vision of the future that was decidedly materialistic, based on a theory he called dialectical materialism. And then finally, the figures like Freud, who came a little bit later, who addressed the human condition and what to do about human guilt. So I point out in the third chapter of the book that between these three figures and other materialistic scientific materialists, the framework of science in the late 19th century answered all the great worldview questions that previously Judeo-Christian theology had answered. Where did we come from? Where are we going? And what do we do about our guilt? What do we do about the human condition? And so materialism became a very much an entrenched worldview by the beginning of the 20th century, and it was understood to be based on science. So scholars call the worldview scientific materialism. Now, the book then tells the story of three really important discoveries that are challenging scientific materialism, challenging the materialistic worldview on its own terms, on the terms of science, and how these three discoveries jointly are supporting not just an argument for intelligent design or an intelligent designer of some sort, but actually, if you really weigh the evidence and the competing metaphysical or worldview hypotheses, I argue that the best explanation for these three pieces of evidence is a designing intelligence that has the attributes that Jews and Christians and other traditional theists have always ascribed to God: transcendence, intelligence, and therefore personhood, and also a willingness, a great power, but also a willingness to be active in the creation. So not a deistic creator, but rather a theistic creator. And the three pieces of evidence or classes of evidence have to do with biological and cosmological origins. And if you've even read the subtitle of the book or done a little perusing, you know that I look at the evidence that supports the discovery that the universe had a beginning, the evidence that the universe has been finely tuned since the beginning to allow for the possibility of life, and the evidence showing that at the foundation of life, there is digital code stored in the DNA molecule and in other similar biomolecules like RNA, and that this information is absolutely crucial to building new forms of life. And so what we've seen in the history of life are large bursts of new biological information, functional digital information that make new forms of life possible. And that's the third class of discovery, the evidence of design from the information-bearing properties of living systems. And I argue that those three pieces of evidence taken together jointly support a theistic design hypothesis over and against a number of potential metaphysical or worldview hypotheses as competitors. So that's a little sketch of the book and why I wrote it. And I'm really excited to take questions.
So Orestes asked this question. I just have to pass this on. He says, what is the large object to the left of your shoulder there?
Thank you.
He wants to know.
We have a colleague, the State University of New York, named Jeffrey Scott Turner, who's written a number of really important books. He's been a non-Darwinian evolutionary biologist. An evolutionary biologist has been skeptical about the Darwinian mechanism. Recently, he's actually in a talk radio interview that was set up that was supposed to be kind of a debate. He actually acknowledged that he is sympathetic to intelligent design as well. I connected him to my former editor from Harper, who is now a book agent, and Roger Freet helped place his Jeff Turner's book with Harper One. So he sent me this big fossil as a thank you, and it's a crinoid fossil. It's a sea lily, a giant sea lily from the Casey will probably know when these things first emerged in the fossil record. But anyway, it's a beautiful fossil.
Very cool.
I've also, above my other shoulder, I have one of Casey's trilobite fossils, which we set up just to make the interview look a little more sciencey.
It's a beautiful specimen.
Yeah.
Okay, so Brian Jocelyn says, can you elaborate on the implications of stacked information systems and DNA, epigenetics, et cetera, on random development and novel body forms? How are you seeing this subject being addressed by naturalists?
It's not being addressed by naturalistic evolutionary. I assume by stacked informational, how did he put it? Stacked?
Stacked information systems. I'm thinking the layers of DNA and epigenetics.
Right. Yeah, the way I refer to that in Darwin's Doubt is a hierarchically arranged information. Okay, so we've got the information you need to build the proteins, but the proteins have to be arranged into biosynthetic pathways that characterize different types of cells. The different types of cells have to be arranged to form specific tissues. The specific tissues have to be arranged to form specific organs. The organs and tissues have to be arranged to form body plans. So one of the arguments in Darwin's Doubt was that the hierarchically arranged information or stacked information that's necessary to build an animal cannot possibly be explained by mutations in the DNA alone. Because even if mutations were sufficient to produce enough information to generate a novel protein fold, and I argue for probabilistic reasons based on Doug Axe's fantastic work about the rarity of genes and proteins in what's called combinatorial sequence space, that random mutations are not a sufficient means of generating enough information to build a new protein fold, protein folds being the fundamental unit of innovation in biological systems. But I argue in Darwin's Death that even if you could solve that problem, even if you could overcome the long odds necessary to get enough information to build a new protein fold, you would still have an insoluble problem, because building a protein does not a body plan make. You've got to arrange the proteins into the biosynthetic pathways and the different cell types into tissues and organs and body plans. And that requires higher levels of information, the location of some of which forms of information we know, and the location of others we do not yet know. But you can mutate DNA till the cows come home indefinitely without recourse to probabilistic limits. And in the best case, all you do is get a new protein, maybe a new protein fold, though I'm not willing to concede that. And that's not going to give you a body plan. And then you have this problem that in Darwin's Death. I also look at what are called developmental gene regulatory networks, and they present a profound conundrum for contemporary neo-Darwinism and all other evolutionary models of animal development, because to build a new form of animal life, you need one of these developmental gene regulatory networks. They're functionally, they're essentially circuits that are controlling the flow of information and that determine the arrangement of different cell types, the distribution of different cell types during animal development. And what we've learned about them is that they cannot be perturbed. If you start monkeying with them in what are called model systems in developmental biology, the organism will simply shut down. It will die. But if you can't perturb a system upon which building a body plan develops, then how do you ever evolve one body plan into another? Because these underlying systems that are responsible for animal development are not mutatable. The core elements are highly resistant to mutational change. And when we tweak them in the lab, you get deleterious or lethal consequences always. So this is the problem known as embryonic lethals. So it's a very astute question. It's an completely unsolved problem, not just by neo-Darwinism, but by the newer models of naturalistic evolution that have been proposed. And yet, when you're looking at a developmental gene regulatory network and you map it functionally, and this has been done by the great developmental biologists, including the late Eric Davidson, it looks exactly like an integrated circuit, except it's the integrated circuit is controlling a flow of information. And so anyway, great question, not solved by naturalistic evolutionary processes. I think it's another powerful evidence of design.
So there's another question here from Cosmology. Richard Evison, he affirms, as you do, that the universe had a beginning, but then he says, if the designer exists outside the universe, as he must, would his continued interaction with and his input into this universe defy what we know with regards to the laws of thermodynamics? So if the designer is separate and outside of our universe, then how does he interact with it?
My short answer to that would be no more than the action of our own minds. We do all kinds of things to manipulate matter, to change its state, to reconfigure it. And the theistic metaphysic suggests that mind is primary and has powers that matter doesn't have. So the Big Bang itself violates the first law of thermodynamics, that matter is neither created nor destroyed. That law has to have at least one caveat, which is matter is neither created nor destroyed except at the beginning of the universe. And so the laws of the thermodynamic laws pertain to what nature will do or typically does on its own. All laws of nature have what are called ceteris paribus clauses, all other things being equal, in other words. And in the case where intelligent agents manipulate material systems, then the predictions we would make about how material systems would operate on their own have to be suspended. It's, in a sense, an all bets are off situation. An illustration I use in the book is the billiard balls on the billiard table or the pool table. And you may, knowing that there's one ball is going to hit another with an exact force and an exact angle, you can make a precise calculation of what the second ball is going to do. But if there's someone who suddenly shakes the table, then all bets are off. We can't in that case. And when our prediction doesn't come true, that doesn't mean the laws of physics have been violated. it means that another force has been introduced into the system that wasn't accounted for in the original prediction, and that intelligent agents have the capability of introducing new events into physical systems that create new lines of cause and effect. So I would say there's a sense in which every act of an agent produces unpredictable outcomes, but it does so without violating the underlying laws of physics and chemistry, which are by definition descriptions of what nature does on its own without intelligent intervention or interference.
That was Daniel Reeves hosting Stephen C. Meyer in an interactive online Q&A session about Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis. The book is available now through all the major online bookstores, and as you can tell from the conversation, it's very much worth reading. If you haven't obtained your copy and started reading it already, well, what are you waiting for? And we encourage you to let friends know about both the book and this podcast. Just steer them to our home at idthefuture.com. Listen again soon here for more from Dr. Meyer and others who are helping show the truth of intelligent design. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.